To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Indeed so. Who loves you, baby? Well, the nanotechnology scientists love you, baby. Right? Because you're a consumer. We'll be right back. Remember, now I could be wrong about this, but I remember I had a VIC-20 computer. Then I had a Commodore 64, and so forth and so on, until today we're up in the 3 gigahertz range someplace or another, 3.6, 3.5, I don't know where we are right now, but I have begun to note that it's slowing down. It doesn't seem to me that we're making the same kind of leaps in computer speed. Certainly in storage we are. It's getting cheaper and bigger and better. But in terms of speed, I think we're slowing down. Now, somebody may call and correct me on that and say it's not true. But it doesn't seem like we're making quite the same doubling leaps that we were making. So we may be approaching some sort of wall. And there are many people who believe that nanotechnology may hold the future. In other words, when it gets too thin and too hard to do with traditional materials, it may be nanotechnology that it makes our next computer. Could that be, Charles?
That's exactly what's happening. In fact, a lot of the people who present at my conferences and people I work with in the venture community, this is precisely what they're doing as we speak.
Really?
A lot of it's sort of under wraps. I mean, people like Intel, for instance, have a huge investment stake in their current infrastructure in terms of traditional CMOS manufacturing, but even they get it. They know quite well that. And let me give you an insight. It's not so much the laws of physics. I mean, there's a so-called Moore's law that says we're going to be doubling computer speed every 6 months or whatever. That's not really relevant.
Stay good and close to the phone for me.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
What is relevant, though, is the cost of the manufacturer. That is, every time you push to a new scale of integration, as they call it, the cost of the fab setup keeps going up exponentially. And so it's really an economic factor rather than a physics factor. So what's being done as we speak? Well, once again, biology comes into the picture quite prominently because we can now use things like viruses to actually move bits of metal around on a surface and essentially grow a circuit as opposed to having to etch one into a piece of silicon.
To grow a circuit.
And in fact, there's a company called Cambrios. They presented at my last conference, and I've known the co-founder, Angie Belcher, for many years. And this is exactly what they're doing. They're using a biological approach to, in a sense, grow complex circuits. But let me give you one other insight, if I may, which might help to get a better sense of this. It's not how fast the machine runs. It's how much in parallel it can operate.
Right.
The real breakthrough.
Right.
So there's a realm of computing called reconfigurable computing, and I won't bore with a lot of technical stuff, but the basic idea is think of it like this. In a way that memory stores data, a reconfigurable platform can temporarily store function. Now, why is that interesting? Here is the reason. Because like in a Pentium, you have to hardwire all of the logic into the system. It's basically software turned into hardware. But if you go into reconfigurable architectures, now all of a sudden you're not confined by the way the system's wired up. And this kind of computing has been around for many years. People like Xilinx and Altera and so forth have been manufacturing silicon chips to do this for quite some time. The problem, though, is that to make enough gates on a piece of silicon so that you can truly hit this plateau of parallelism that really breaks open this realm of computing has still been kind of expensive. So if you go to places like Hewlett-Packard, for instance, where they've been working on this very, very hard for a handful of years, they're probably going to be the first company to come out with the kind of nano approach, if you will, to a reconfigurable architecture that happens to use, by the way, organic molecules as the switches. on a sea of gates where you, by a factor of many orders of magnitude, have many more gates sort of compressed under the same surface. And the reason this is a big deal is because, unlike a Pentium or something like it, where even a tiny percentage of gate failure means that the whole device is useless.
Again, this is getting very fuzzy, though. In other words, we're beginning to talk about sort of something almost not a machine, something more or at least maybe halfway organic and halfway machine.
Well, as a matter of fact...
Listen here, Charles, that starts to sound like the creation of life, buddy.
Well, actually, there is an entire genre of science called artificial life. I've been a part of this community for many, many years. There's actually a conference every year called GECCO, which is the Genetic and Evolutionary Computing Conference, and that's exactly what this is about. It's about using reconfigurable platforms to, in a sense, mimic lifelike processes. And if I were to go so far as to say, in the near future, when you're going to see neural networks and things like this much more commonplace than they have been in the past, the thing that makes that possible is this kind of reconfigurable computing. So yes, you are right. The boundary between living and non-living things is becoming ever more diffuse. And if I may tap back into the bit just before the break with the neural interface.
The man with the chip in it.
Yes, in fact, that company is called CyberKinetics, and they actually have a website you can go to if you wish. But the point I was hoping to make was, it's not just being able to put a chip in the brain. The next step is to read the brain's signatures from outside the brain. And this has been done for years, actually, using something called a superconductive quantum interference device. That sounds like a mouthful, but it's called squid detectors for short. The problem with the squids in the past was they had to be cryogenically cooled in liquid helium to make them useful. And when Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was testing these ideas, probably at the same time the Russians were, you had a device the size of a large trash can filled with liquid helium, with a pilot strap beneath it so they could read his thoughts. Well, technically it sort of worked, but, I mean, nobody's going to put that into an aircraft. But you had the idea right that if a pilot could think faster than he could move his hands and feet around, the problem being that the performance of the aircraft physically exceed the physical ability of the pilot to sustain those kind of G-forces. So if they could buy a few milliseconds of extra time, or shorten the time, rather, between the responses of a perceived threat and response, that sort of thing, then all of a sudden they buy themselves another half a G of force exerted on the pilot. Now, where nanotechnology comes in...
Either that or you don't put a pilot in there at all.
Thank you. That's kind of where we're going with this.
Yeah, you have somebody on the ground connected to a computer, part of a computer,
that's
operating
right.
This machine.
Well, actually, you've read my mind. Thank you. That's kind of where things are going. So the basic idea is this, and if you saw the film Brainstorm, there were some technical weaknesses, but the concept was kind of there. Imagine nanotechnology now creating a new kind of superconductive material that does not require cryogenic cooling, and that's exactly where this is going.
Have you seen a new movie, Charles, about this wonderful chip that's implanted in some people when they're born? And all it does, Charles, is record what they see, virtually records actually their entire life, and then when they die, a sort of a memorial is made of them using the hopefully morally higher moments of their life. And
I haven't seen the film, but I can appreciate the concept. But let me give you one quick snapshot that kind of parallels this. I was actually part of something called the Ubiquitous Computing Forum a couple of years ago near the Stanford campus. They have this event every so often. And one of my friends, Jim Hurd, who runs something called the Nanoscience Exchange, he was making kind of a joke in a way, but it wasn't that much of a joke. He said, well, Charles, at some point, we're going to be able to read people's consciousness in real time and tie that to their income stream so that every thought that you make can be referenced to whoever is owed that effort, if you will. And that'll become the kind of socioeconomic structure of the future.
God.
Well, a bunch of people laughed, but some of them weren't laughing because the technology is sort of halfway there. That's just like a little glimpse of that kind of thinking.
All right, back to the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Good morning.
Good morning. Is this me?
That's you.
Okay, hey, thank you, Art, for letting me come on your show here. Charles, I believe you and my brother, Mark Lindemann, used to work together at Lawrence Livermore, and I got a question for you. What about natural harnessing of the Earth and the magnetism of the Earth for free space transmission of electricity?
As for Tesla. No, I understand. As for Nikola Tesla. I think Tesla was right on the mark, and I think that he was horribly mistreated. His records were seized by the government, and a lot of controversy exists about what he had done or not done. Is a huge potential in this. As a kind of a quick snapshot of that idea, you recall when the space shuttle had the tether experiment, they towed a large line a couple miles long behind the space shuttle, and it collected so much electricity, they were astonished. It was way beyond what they expected. In fact, the line kind of blew up because it had too much current.
Mm-hmm.
They canceled the program. I wonder why.
Yes, I do too. Everybody, including myself, sat straight up, eyes wide open when that happened and said, oh, my God. But on the other side, as you point out, gosh, they canceled the program. They didn't give it another thought.
Yep.
Publicly.
Well, you know, Art, in your own experience with your giant 13-tower array or however many towers you have there, and you were getting all this voltage that you couldn't understand, I think you tapped into something interesting. And I would just let it hang at that, that there's a lot to be said for this yet to be publicly made available.
No doubt. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Hello.
Good evening. Thanks, Mr. Bell, for another really interesting program. My question is this. At the start of the program, there was a comment about tying this to last week's program, which was dealing with the decline of oil production.
Right.
And the impact on society of not cheap energy. And I've not heard any reference to what kind of energy it takes to do this nanotechnology.
Ah, actually, what a wonderful question. Every energy seems to, I mean, even hydrogen, one of the great arguments is it's going to cost a lot of energy to produce these hydrogen fuel cells. So what about nanotechnology? What kind of energy?
Sure, that's a great question, and I think I might be able to provide an answer. The theory is that unlike traditional manufacturing systems where you have to do a lot of effort to carve and shape and mold and sort of squeeze into some kind of a usable form, you know, chunks of metal or ceramics or whatever it is, nanotech's sort of the other direction. You're actually getting molecules to assemble themselves into something hopefully useful. So, interestingly enough, the amount of energy it takes to get that kind of a process to work is a tiny fraction of the process that it takes to whittle something down to a smaller size. So, I mean, it's a good question, but the answer is, in fact, it's remarkably energy efficient. That's why it's so interesting. That's why so many people are looking at it as we speak.
Is it in itself a source of energy?
Not directly, but certainly in terms of being able to harvest energy from otherwise unharvestable circumstances. I think that's really where the target goal would eventually go.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Tim from St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes.
My question is, with the nanotechnology that he's talking about as far as medical use goes,
right?
I'm wondering if sometime down the line whether or not surgeries won't even be possible or even be needed.
I'm sorry, surgery?
Surgery. In other words, could this actually take over, instead of cutting open the body to get some job done, it virtually eliminates the job of the surgeon?
I think that's where they want to go. In other words, if you look at the cost of healthcare, and not to sound too, you know, sort of, economical or financially oriented, but I mean, that's kind of the motivation. The theory is that right now, surgery is kind of a sloppy process, and I mean that with great respect to everybody in surgery. I just come out of surgery myself, as a matter of fact, a few days ago. But it's kind of a sloppy part. You have to sort of cut things open and dig around and pull out the bad stuff or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah.
And throw something else
out. Sometimes you got to crack ribs and do serious stuff.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. I went through dental surgery where that saw my jaw open. So, I mean, I know this process. So the point is, obviously, could we want to get at the damaged area or the area to be changed through some kind of means that has to do with not cutting the body open, but simply putting something in the body that can sort of do the repair and then leave again.
Here, here.
And, of course, that would be the ultimate target goal. Now, how close are we to this? Obviously, depends on the kind of surgery and the kind of operation, but certainly people are talking about it. And a lot of the companies who are kind of migrating this direction, I'm just going to throw a guess out there, maybe 10, 12 years from that, you might see something along these lines that would begin to appear.
All right,
horizon.
Well, let me give you a good one.
Sure.
I mentioned cracked ribs.
Sure.
To get a bypass, baby, they crack your ribs.
I believe you, sure.
Okay, so a bypass is done because arteries or whatever are plugged up.
Correct.
And it would seem to me it would be the ideal job for little nano machines to go and target and clean out the pipes.
As a matter of fact, Rutgers University has a animation you can download where they show this exact procedure being done as a sort of a nanobiological procedure.
Wow.
And, yes, people are talking about it. In fact, this is exactly why the FDA is struggling with how to define medicine, because medicine, like I said, will become more of a chemo-mechanical process. Now, whether it's like little metal machines or little cutters or something, or whether it's more of a biologically assisted process, that could be a debate, but certainly that's the ultimate goal. And clearing plaque of arteries is considered one of the major financially interesting targets of the current genre of pharmacy.
It would be worth a lot of money. First time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Good morning.
Thank you very much for taking my call, Art, and thank you for having this wonderful program. My question relates to, has there been any thought given to utilizing one's own human energy, whether it be electrical or vibrational, to assist with, for example, body temperature regulation in environments in place of consuming fossil fuels?
Well, I'm not sure I can address that question, but I would like to address a sort of a parallel area of interest that I'm personally fascinated by, and that is the use of consciousness as a instrument of influence. Elizabeth Targ, as you probably know, recently passed away, which is very sad, but she was a medical doctor and a PhD who spent many years of her life researching this exact phenomenon in a very technical kind of way. She's the daughter of Russell Targ, who's quite well known as well.
Of course.
The point being that a lot of folks are now beginning to unravel the connection between what I might call biophysical processes and perhaps quantum physical processes. You know, do we have the ability to focus our intentionality as a healing instrument? And the answer is, maybe. There's a lot of evidence to support this concept. So I'm not sure I want to go as far as saying, do we need to not use heat because we can change our own body temperature? I'm not sure I want to go there.
Well, one of her questions, if I heard it correctly,
okay,
was
sure.
could we use, for example, we know that there are very tiny electrical impulses in the body.
Absolutely.
Generated and passed on in
sure.
various ways, nerves and the rest of it to the brain.
Absolutely.
Could some of that energy be used to power nanotechnological machines?
Well, in a sense, yes, because even though the amount of current involved is very tiny, if you're working at the nanoscale, the amount of current required is also very tiny.
Very tiny,
and
yes.
That's, in fact, the motivation to go in this direction in the first place.
I think that was the essence of the question.
Okay, sure.
So that would be a yes.
Yeah, that would be a yes, sir.
Okay. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Okay, sir. You're on the air.
Well, Art, I'd like to say it is a true privilege to be able to talk to you.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by saying new spy equipment. I heard a show that George did about a month ago.
Okay.
And over-the-counter spy equipment is very effective and very advanced, and I was wondering how that might affect this kind of thing. But not only that, I mean, I'd like to reference Michael Crichton again by saying sometimes we're so enamored by what we can accomplish, and we just don't think about whether we should or not.
Bingo.
Well, and by that I mean by hackers, and yeah. by not only by hackers and how that might be involved, but also by nature, be it massive power storms and referencing your show on climate change and all that, and if magnetism might have a part to play in that.
All right, well, we're all over the place. Let's go back to where you began. Could we get something from nanotechnology that would be, I don't know, like a housefly. Something as small
as
a housefly.
Art, I'm not making this up. I swear this is true. There actually is a project called RoboFly. I'm not kidding.
RoboFly.
Correct. So, I'm now stepping to some gray zones I probably shouldn't go into.
Oh, no, go right ahead.
Well, okay, this is what's been published. I'll just put it that way. Department of the Army, particularly, one, was very interested in mimicking biological behavior in creating kind of like artificial bugs, you know, flying things.
Yes.
And their earlier versions were like a large dragonfly, so they could fly around, it would have sensors, it would pick up things like biological things, for instance, that we, but also have other kinds of detectors. And here at UC Berkeley, there was the RoboFly project, sort of like the smaller version of this. Now, it got taken away and sent to Southern California, and I won't necessarily go into where it's gone to.
It got taken away.
Well, but that's the whole point. They are actually working on a fly, literally, as we speak. So, yes, you're right. Give it a couple, 3 years, and the fly you see buzzing around may or may not be an organic fly. I'll just leave it at that.
All right, plus the fact that what if the little machine bug was actually a bee? And had a sting, a really good sting. a sting that actually was fatal.
Well, yes, this could be one of the uses. I mean, the version I saw, let's put it that way, was meant as a sensory system. But who's to say it couldn't be used as an offensive system as well?
Yeah, who's to say? Enough like that, and you truly would have the sounds of silence.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
We'll be back in a moment.
I've come to talk with you again.
In the middle of the night, in the darkness, this is Coast to Coast AM. Charles Ostman is here, and we're talking about nanotechnology.
Left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. Restless dreams I walked along, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sun.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
And Charles Ostman. We're talking about nanotechnology, the pluses and minuses, and there's plenty of both, and they're happening right now. And I wonder if you all get the same sense I do as we talk about this with Charles, that there's an awful lot he knows. And there's an awful lot he, I think, suspects that he doesn't talk about. Back now to the Nano World with Charles Ostman, my guest. Good morning, everybody. Charles, are you there?
I am certainly here.
Good. We've certainly covered an awful lot of ground this morning, haven't we? Is there anything, before I go back to the phones, that we have not covered that we should have?
Well, maybe not exactly, but the ad you just had on talking about the LED light bulbs, that's a perfect example of how we can improve energy consumption profile, because the next generation of LEDs will be, in a sense, nano-enabled.
Well, they're astounding. I mean, LEDs have come... Oh, my God, they have come so far in our lifetime, and now they have these versions, as were advertised, that plug into a 110-volt socket,
yeah,
and the amount of current you use is almost, you almost can't calculate
it. It's a tiny fraction, and that's exactly right. And now let's take it a step further. Let's say we had the next sort of nano-enabled version of LEDs, which is really right around the corner.
Right.
And even 10% of the population using those bulbs would dramatically, and I mean really dramatically, change our entire energy consumption profile.
It's true.
From a grid standpoint, yeah.
All right, back to the phones. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Morning.
I'm on the air?
You are.
Okay. My name is Burke Brunson, and I'm currently an undergraduate.
Okay, first of all, you're not allowed to use last names on the air.
Oh,
so
I do apologize.
I had to take that out. Let us begin again. Your first name is?
My name is Burke.
And you're a undergraduate student where?
At the University of Alabama.
Excellent, okay.
I'm currently studying chemistry and biology, and I plan to enter medical school in 2006. But in addition to studying for medical school, I want to conduct research one day as well. I am currently conducting research in nanoscience and nanotechnology and its possible application into biological entities as an undergraduate student. And I just thought it might be interesting to get Mr. Osman's reaction to the fact that, you know, even people as young and inexperienced as undergraduate students are working in this field and working to become experts in this area that y'all have been discussing all night.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the NNI, the National Nanotechnology Initiative, which in a very tiny way I sort of participated in through the Institute for Global Futures, we submitted some of the policy statements. This is exactly where they're going. They want to, in a very progressive and positive way, influence as many of the major schools as possible to include this in their curriculum. This is absolutely a government directive, and big universities are getting government support to make this possible. That's exactly right.
Well, I see it from another angle. In other words, students working on this in universities, gosh, I remember an old TV show where a ninth grader built a perfect atomic bomb minus the actual plutonium that would have to be in there. Otherwise, perfect. And the comment at the time, kind of comical, was, you know, think what seniors can do.
Well, actually, an atomic bomb is actually a fairly simple thing to make. It's just the parts are hard to get, but the concept's very simple. And again, this goes back to the very beginning of the show. I am not trying to, in a Pollyannish way, say, oh, there's nothing terrible with all this. I'm just saying that this is we're here, just like you so correctly point out. So what do we do? As a species, as a sort of anthropological system, do we decide to pretend it's not there? That's
no.
not going to work because the rest of the world's going to go ahead anyway.
Right.
So let's try to do the best we can to understand what this is, apply it in a good way, and let me offer one little caveat since it's great that a student would call. Just think of this for a moment. Right now we're in Iraq in a war basically for oil. We sort of know that. We're probably going to get into other wars in the future, basically competing over resources.
Oh, wait a minute. It's not oil. It was weapons of mass destruction.
Well, okay.
We all know it was
weapons of mass destruction. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Okay, fine. But the point is, what if suddenly, or over a handful of years, we could alleviate much of the problems that are, I mean, if we think we're in trouble now, wait till China really gets online.
I know what happened to those weapons. Selective disassembly.
Yeah, well, there we go. But the point being, I'm just trying to hopefully point in the direction here, that if we could use nanotechnology to sort of alleviate a lot of the stress that we are now encountering because of access to energy and also things like food and water access and climate and a whole variety of things, which I think could have at least the possibility of being affected in a positive way, then the need for things like aggressive warfare-orientated, you know, policies would not be so much prevalent. That's just a guess, but it's a one to consider.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hi.
Good morning. This is Joe in Michigan.
Hey.
Basically, I want to shoot out two questions and then catch the answer off the air.
All
basically,
right.
It sounds to me like maybe the T-1000 from Terminator 2 would be possible, and also... Perhaps even he's talking about bulletproof suits. How about an armored suit that gives you super strength, flying the whole nine yards straight out of the comic books? How far off is that?
All right, good.
Well, actually, going back to the super soldier project at MIT, the whole idea of smart exoskeletons is, in fact, really on the drawing board. That is one of the things they're looking at. I don't know about flying necessarily, but certainly one that would be ultra tough, would enhance human strength, would the bio and chemical weapon resistant, you know, that is genre of thinking. Yeah, absolutely, that's kind of where things are going. You know, how far this gets into the area of, like, the Terminator cyborg stuff, I suppose in the extreme outer frontier where humans are seen as ever less important in the role of warfare and machines replace them, you know, I mean, yeah, there is a logical path towards that. I'm not sure I'm even able to comment on how far it would go or not go, but it's within the realm of possibility. I won't say it's not.
All right, good enough. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Good morning.
Yeah, this is Ed from St. Louis.
Hey, Ed.
And I was wanting to ask Charles, is this photovoltaic paint actually available now, and who would we contact? Is there websites?
I'll go for that. I'd like to know, too.
Well, I don't know about the paint specifically, because I haven't interacted with the company that produces it, but I have interacted with companies who are producing the printed foils or the laminates that are organic material-based solar photovoltaics.
And they're available now.
And they're available now. NanoSolar is one of the companies in existence that I know personally.
All right. But as far as paint is concerned, sir, I'm pretty sure it's available now. I'm sorry I don't have the information.
Yeah, I don't have the name of the company.
If I were you, I'd go to Google, put in NanoPaint, and I'll bet you get some returns.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck. I'm interested as well. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Good morning. Hello?
Hi.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes?
Hi, this is Ben calling from St. George, Utah.
Okay.
I just had a couple of questions, and I'll listen off the air.
All right.
I was just wondering if there was any possibility that maybe nanotechnology could be used to create some kind of a container for nuclear waste, and seamless, non-porous.
Right. A container for nuclear waste. That's a very good question. Your second one?
Well, if there was any way to create some kind of a combustible fluid or, liquid similar to gas, I guess, to replace oil.
Okay, well, we kind of covered that one already. You said it's not so necessarily directly able to produce a consumable energy matter. But with reference to the first question, now there is a good one.
Well, actually, I have sort of a quasi-answer, and I'll go as follows. Back in the mid-70s, when Carl Gustav actually came to, he's the king of Sweden, he actually came to Lawrence Laboratory and said, whatever it costs, I'll spend the money, but I want you guys to invent a solution for this, because they were concerned even then. And they were burying their nuclear waste in iron mines at the time. We said the best solution we have to date was borosilicate glass and making little sort of glass pellets, and they would encapsulate bits and pieces of the spent fuel rods and then put those inside of sealed drums. But even with the borosilicate glass, it still has it degrades over time. And so we were concerned about, could we invent a better material? Well, theoretically, I think that would be a direction to go in. I don't know of any projects where that's actually being done, but I think the theory is worthy of consideration, sure.
Okay, so nanotechnology, that does make sense. I mean, it make a stronger, harder, longer-lasting, self-repairing container, one where we could be certain that a woman in high heels couldn't walk up and kick it and have a nuclear spill.
Hopefully not, but yes, the whole idea of having a material that would hold up under the bombardment of nuclear fission over time, that's exactly what you're looking for. That's
because right. I know they've dumped these containers out the back of trucks, they've had train collisions, but
they
have not yet encountered an angry woman in high heels.
No comment.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osman.
Yes, I'm Charles on Kauai.
Oh, Kauai.
Yes, I'd like to ask about using nanotechnology to make billions of diodes in consistent alignment parallel, which would rectify Johnson noise, the thermal radiostatic, so you'd turn background ambient uniform heat into electricity.
God,
I think it's a wonderful idea. Well,
yeah.
Wait. I think I know who you are. There's a company I tried to reach, and the website was very limited, and I won't mention it on the air, but I know who this is, I think.
There are a number of people, and I've heard this over the years, who have talked about back-to-back diodes.
Yes, and nanodiodes would do this.
Nanodiodes would do that.
And in fact, if this is the person who I think it is, I would like to invite them to present at our next conference, because that's exactly the kind of stuff we're looking for. So
all right.
This is irrelevant.
Listen, while we're at it, why don't you give out a way for people to contact you?
I'll give out my email. I know I'll get fresh, but that's okay. I don't mind at all.
All right.
It's charles000@aol.com.
Charles000@aol.com.
And if this is the nanodiode array person who has a small company, and I think I saw some information earlier, and wants to present at our conference, please send information. We'll be happy to talk with you.
I believe it may be. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hello.
Are you talking to me, sir?
I'm talking to you.
Okay, I was the one, I didn't know I wasn't allowed to put my brother's name out there. I brought up the Nikola Tesla thing.
Uh-huh.
I apologize.
All right, well, you're only allowed on the air one time per night, so I'm sorry. You're on the air, Wildcard Line with Charles Osman. Hi.
How you doing? Brian in Miami?
Yes.
I was wondering, nature kind of finds its way all the time, so I was kind of wondering if even the most minute polar shift or an incredible, like, climactal electrical storm might have an effect on even just one of the...
Have an effect on what?
On one of these little nanobytes, because I understand that it's going to take millions to basically do what everyone has said it's going to do, and they're always going to be grouped. So even if one has a flaw, what's going to happen with the rest of them?
Let me see if I can try to clear this up. Nanotechnology is not about little machines. Little machines are like one very small, sorry for the choice of words, very narrow aspect of a much wider technical domain of what falls into the category of sort of nanosciences. So I think a lot of people have read the book Prey and kind of think it's a bunch of nanites running around causing harm. It's not that at all. Yes, there will be, I think, a segment of the nano research community who will be looking into controllable nano devices to manufacture certain kinds of materials and that sort of thing.
Mm.
But this is actually a very small minority of the entire genre of applied nanotechnology. In fact, I'm glad the caller called because I think this is a concern a lot of people have. The vast majority of nanotechnology-related companies and projects have nothing to do at all with nanites or anything like this at all. It's just a very small segment of the larger population.
How much chance is there, Charles, that even unintentionally, something's going to get out of control?
I understand. And as I was saying earlier, my biggest fear would be in this sort of combined arena of either proteomic targeting and or some kind of selective disassembly experiment that, you know, wasn't meant to get out, but somehow it does, or gets smuggled out or something. That, you know, that in my mind would be the worst of all the possibilities.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Good morning.
Hello?
Hi.
Is this me?
Well, it sounds like you.
Okay, here I go. My name is Charles Ostman, calling from Miami 610.
Yes.
Things that they could take a molecule apart?
In some cases, yes. In fact, if you look at biology, that's what biology does all the time, and all we're trying to do is, in a sense, replicate a small portion of that process.
Well, what I'm thinking is maybe they could get all this radioactive material and change it into platinum and gold.
I have a story for you, and you'll appreciate this. In 1976, at Lawrence Laboratory, we changed lead into gold. I'm not making this up. This really happened. However, there's a small caveat. In order to do this, we had to accelerate, it's a long story, but we had to use a combination of a linear accelerator and a cyclotron to pre-accelerate particles so we could sort of smash open the nuclei of the lead particle or lead atoms to make them into gold. The problem with that process is that the energy expended was about $30,000 per gram, or roughly there. However, if one went to a superconductive acceleration platform, which is very much in the possibility of today's world, there could come a time where you really could reconstruct elements to suit a desired goal. And certainly, not so much gold, that's a sort of a class by itself, but other materials which are much rarer, specialized metals that are used for all kinds of alloys and so forth, excuse me, could there be a way, right now our only choice is to dig holes in the ground and smelt metal, and that's kind of a damaging process, and it's also very limited. If you think oil is a problem, wait until we run out of other more precious materials like vanadium or cobalt, etc., which is very important for a number of reasons. So could we, in a sense, fabricate these elements by manipulating the nuclei of atoms? Yes, we could, get the energy cost down. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Charles, let me ask you kind of an overall question, and I was sort of joking at the bottom of the hour, but it's really not a joke. If I want an absolute honest guess here. Across the private sector and across the government sector, what percentage of nanotechnology development is public information versus secret information?
Boy, that's a tough question. I'm trying to give you an honest answer. I'm not sure I have one exactly, but I would say...
A guess, that's what I'm asking. An honest
probably
guess.
Half and half, roughly.
Half and half?
Yeah, I would say roughly.
Very generous, actually.
That's just my guess. That's just a guess.
All right. International Line, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Hello.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, this is Ed from Modesto, California.
Oh, Ed, I'm sorry. You're on the wrong line, bud. This is our international line. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Hi.
Well, hi, Charles. I had a quick question. Are CO2 scrubbers being created with nanotechnology since we're going to double the number of coal-fired plants in the next 10 years?
Whether we like it or not, I guess, huh?
Well, actually, there's something to be said for this. A couple of quick thoughts. CO2 scrubbing is one of many different pathways to figure out a better way to clean out the harmful residue of coal burning. Another are interesting ways to use coal, and where nanotechnology comes in really well, as a matter of fact, is in making nanoparticles of coal to make new kinds of cleaner burning fuels. There's actually a program going on to create sort of coal-generated diesel fuel, which is very interesting indeed. And there's a much larger arena of projects, actually one in China, which I'm quite familiar with, which is actually trying to perfect a way to grind coal into very perfectly sized nanogranules so that the coal burns extremely cleanly and becomes a much more usable fuel as opposed to how it is now.
Charles, we're running out of time, but I've got one final question.
Sure.
Is there any possible dreamed-of application for nanotechnology in climate modification?
Wow. Well, I would think that on the sort of dark side, if you want to call it that, the whole HARP idea, if we could, I want to say this carefully, if one dramatically changed the power density of these transmitters, all kinds of things could happen. And that could be a good or a bad thing.
Are you admitting that you understand that HARP is being used for climate modification?
I would say,
is that what I just heard?
I'll offer it a very qualified guess. I'll just put it that way.
Okay.
And I mean, the HARP is not the only machine like this. There's a number of HARPs out there in the world. The fact that the Russians wanted to offer as a commercial service
yes.
the business of changing the storm paths of typhoons, that kind of thing, kind of suggests where that's going.
I'm well aware. Buddy, we're all done. Again, your email address is?
charles000@aol.com.
Have a great night, buddy.
You too.
Talk to you next time.
Thanks so much.
It's been an incredible weekend, a wonderful weekend. Thank you all. Have a great week. From the high desert, good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. Magical journey will take us on a ride. Filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight.